The Honorable Justice of the United States Court of Appeals, in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is the United States versus Alanis and all. Ms. Volta.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We are here to ask you to reverse the convictions of the three defendants for what amounts to six significant structural and substantive errors at the trial level. One, the violation of the defendant's due process and Sixth Amendment rights stemming from the court's refusal to grant a hearing on a new trial motion involving the testimony of Attorney Rusin and his perjurious testimony concerning his billing records or the absence thereof.
But the district court didn't think it was perjurious testimony. She thought that when you looked at the cross-examination at a whole, maybe he had misremembered some things, but it's a far cry, as I'm sure you've argued in a different context in the past between making a mistake and committing perjury.
Judge, I would submit that the district court's finding in that respect is error. The testimony from Attorney Rusin was unequivocal. The records do not exist. We cannot retrieve them. They were not computerized for the years in question. And consequently, we can't determine, we cannot come up with the billing records. When a subsequent witness testified, he had them right at his fingertips. He said it was easy to retrieve them. And the real issue is, which I think that there's a clear falsity in the testimony by Attorney Rusin. I think there was motive for Attorney Rusin to lie in that respect. And I think that the issue to which that factual matter goes is significant. Attorney Rusin's testimony was the only testimony in the record that alluded in any way to a so-called bribe. His was the only one where he suggested that the receipt of business from Alexis was conditioned on his agreement to take kickbacks. Every other witness testified insofar as the scheme was concerned that it was an agreement to split what was amounted to a theft from Alexis. Attorney Rusin's testimony was bolstered by his assertion that the bribe took place and it could be demonstrated by the fact that his firm lost business following his rejection of the bribe attempt. Well, in fact, those billing records demonstrated that not only did his firm not lose business, but his firm's business increased from Alexis. So the district court's determination, in our estimation, that the testimony of Attorney Rusin was not false was an error, and the refusal to conduct a hearing on a new trial motion relating to the existence of those records and Rusin's denial that they existed during trial amounts to reversible error.
But the government on page 34 of its brief indicates that on cross-examination, Attorney Rusin testifies that after the fall of 91, his firm received new cases from Alexis clients, but they were clients they'd been handling before, and as for new business, he says, and they quote, "I can't honestly say, I know I didn't receive any more files from Mr. Hendershot." And they go on and say that although there was new business, a lot of it was from offices, not the Chicago office. In other words, it does seem that it's a much more complicated situation than what you're portraying, and again, one which seems to me on the standard of review we have, if the district court thought that this wasn't perjury, it's hard to say she was in error.
I believe that the government's arguments as to what the appropriate inferences should be from the cross-examination begs the issue. From our perspective, it's the denial of the right of cross-examination that was impacted by the absence of the records.
What did you do to enforce your subpoena?
Prior to the testimony of Rusin, Your Honor, the defense served a Rule 17 subpoena. They anticipated, in part, this issue. When Rusin refused or failed to produce the records, he was questioned during the trial concerning the existence or non-existence.
Before the trial, what did you do to enforce your subpoena?
Well, other than receiving...
Did you go before the court and say that he's not correspond, that he is not cooperating?
He
will not turn it over?
During the trial, Your Honor, he testified that they didn't exist and that he couldn't produce them.
I said before the trial.
To my knowledge, there was no action taken prior to trial.
That's what I'm asking. So you didn't do anything other than issue the subpoena?
They issued the subpoena. And
period.
Right.
And they you didn't get to your material. You did not call that to the attention of the court and say that we can't proceed because we don't have it. Could you help us?
I don't recall that occurred, Your Honor.
Did it?
I was not the trial
lawyer,
but I don't recall seeing anything in the record that suggested that. What I do know is that Rusin was questioned about the absence of records during trial.
That I understand.
And denied that they existed.
My question only went to what did you do before trial?
In addition to the records stemming from the Rusin matter, Your Honor, and we think the Rusin matter is significant because not only did it impact the Sixth Amendment right of the defendants to cross-examine a witness who was billed by the government as its golden witness, one without a record and one without immunity. The Rusin testimony is the only testimony that gives a basis to the district court's conclusion that the appropriate sentencing guidelines should be the commercial bribery sentencing guidelines. If Rusin's testimony had been permitted to be fully cross-examined and the record established as defendants believe it would have been, we believe that it would be crystal clear that the district court erred when it applied the commercial bribery sentencing guidelines in this case. And that's a second error that we seek a reversal of the decision of the lower court.
Now, Ms. Bogart, but you are not claiming surprise, right?
Surprise in what respect, Your Honor?
That about his testimony once on the stand.
I
mean, he did not respond. There was no enforcement, the seeking of enforcement. So at least you went to trial knowing he was going to appear recordless, shall we say.
I don't know what the knowledge of the defense was on that issue, Judge. What I do know is that a Rule 17 subpoena is a trial subpoena. It calls for bringing records to the trial. And to my knowledge, it wasn't.
Counsel wouldn't go to trial looking for the witness to produce him that day if they could get him before. Right?
If they could get him before, but if they couldn't, I think the only point at
which... Well, I mean, from a silent record, I guess we've got to conclude there was no request for judicial enforcement.
I don't believe that there was a request for judicial enforcement, Your Honor, until such time as they learned post-trial when the FBI interviewed a witness concerning the dissemination of Rusin's testimony to prospective witnesses that the records actually existed. Up until that point, they had...
Your position in the other business records the government presented couldn't have carried the day standing alone?
No. They didn't demonstrate the fact that the Alexis business not only remained the same, but increased during the time or following the date of this crucial meeting.
But why, I mean, I understand Judge Flom's question. Why isn't that somewhat peripheral in light of all the evidence that the government has that what Mr. Hendershot was doing with Mr. Batista and Mr. Lannis was depriving Alexis of his honest services? He had this elaborate scheme in place where there would be overbillings and where there would be money, kickbacks being sent back to people. Whether one particular law firm gets more or less business from Alexis seems like only a piece of the puzzle.
In our estimation, Your Honor, the Rusin testimony frankly affects or infects the entire proceeding for this reason. Rusin is the only witness who testified that there was a bribe associated with the business. All the other witnesses' testimony was this was a agreement to split the profits after raising the bills or billing for phony business.
Billing for phony business and submitting duplicate reports as though they were new. I mean, there was a lot of dishonesty going on in this building.
Nobody's arguing with the testimony regarding the other witnesses, other than the fact that we contend there's insufficient basis for conviction due to the mailings issue and the record insofar as Hendershot's departure in May. I've moved into my rebuttal time, but I would like to say that we think that the Rusin testimony is a pivotal point. It's the only testimony that ties counts 1 and 2 to counts 3. It's the underpinnings of the district court's sentencing determinations, and it was not fully explored on cross-examination.
Thank you, Ms. Bogart. Mr. Bindi.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'd like to clear up a few things. First of all, Mr. Rusin's testimony was not the only evidence or the only testimony in the case that characterized what was going on here as a bribe, a commercial bribery scheme. Michael Levine, Mr. Lantini, Mr. Hurley, all those witnesses testified that paying Hendershot money was a precondition for getting Alexis business from Mr. Hendershot. That describes a bribery scheme. So Mr. Rusin's testimony was not something that was pivotal as far as that goes. Second, it was obviously for the same reason, not the only basis on which the district court chose the commercial bribery guideline for sentencing purposes. the district court opted for that guideline because the district court found that it more aptly covered the conduct that was charged in the indictment.
Mr. Bindi, I wanted to ask you just one specific question about that. Even if that's correct with respect to Mr. Hendershot and Mr. Batista, what about Mr. Lannis? Commercial bribery seems like a more awkward fit for his offense than it does for the other two.
Well, Mr. Lannis is in a little bit different situation because he's the one here, the one of the three defendants who's paying the bribe rather than receiving it. We submit that it's still a correct characterization of his conduct, that this is a commercial bribery scheme. Bribery is a two-way street. He fits within the commercial bribery guideline because that is the conduct that is charged as to all three defendants in the indictment. It's what the indictment describes.
But why is this a mail fraud indictment then? I mean, why didn't you indict him for a bribery?
Well, that's the jurisdictional
right
requirement here. That makes it a federal offense.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing I wanted to clear up was the assertion that the mail frauds that the mailings were not in furtherance of the scheme because they took place after Mr. Hendershot left Alexis. I heard Ms. Bogart refer to his departure as occurring sometime in May of 1994. The record actually shows that his resignation letter to Alexis was in July of 1994 and that his resignation was effective in August of 1994, which is subsequent to all three of the mailings charged in the indictment. I believe the May date refers to testimony regarding when his files were being audited, and it could be the recollection of one of the witnesses based on somebody else's telling him that Hendershot had left as of May, but that was not the case. The evidence, the documentary evidence showed that he didn't leave until August of 1994.
Could I ask you also about the commercial bribery versus fraud issue? The district court kind of in passing says, oh, well, it might not make any difference anyway because if there were more than minimal planning, they wind up being the same. But she doesn't actually make a finding that either one is satisfied. Is the record sufficient to say that that this doesn't matter?
I think so, Your Honor. More than minimal planning is satisfied if there are repeated acts over a period of time. It applies to all three of them. Obviously, you know, this was a scheme that ran for a couple of years. It involved payments of multiple bribes by all of the vendors. So there are repeated acts over time. There's also sophisticated efforts to conceal the fraud. I think there's an abundance of evidence in the record that more than minimal planning is present here. The judge didn't specifically find that there was more than minimal planning, but I think the record will bear out that she said it was almost certainly going to be the case if she applied 2F1.1. There really is no difference between what the guidelines calculations would have been depending on which guideline was selected.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bogart. Ms. Bogart asked to that last point. Would a remand what would it give us? More specificity, do you feel, from Judge Ballmer?
To answer, yes, I think it would, Judge. And I also think it may give us a different result insofar as each of the defendants is concerned.
You really feel factually that could occur here?
I believe it. Well, I can't predict.
No,
what
I understand.
I mean,
she made that global statement.
Right.
So I'm just trying to I don't want to suggest you've only got a remand case here. I'm not prejudging. But as to this single issue, I like Judge Wood, and perhaps Judge Coffey, have some concern on the F1 versus the B4. And I don't want to involve in a useless act. But
what I do know, Judge, is that the district court increased the sentence of all the defendant Hendershot and Batista by 4 points because they were leaders and planners,
right.
And by 3 points, or one was the leader, one was the manager, and by 3 points because they abused, Mr. Hendershot abused trust. I don't know, frankly, what the district court would do with the also additional argument that two more points should be added to the base level because there's more than minimum planning, and whether the district court might back off of those additional add-ons for the overall sentence.
Or for a particular defendant.
For any particular defendant.
Yeah, there's nothing as a matter of law that would preclude her from doing so. It's not like they overlap and you've already encompassed more than minimal planning. And
nothing's a matter of law, Judge, but I don't think the factual record is here to permit a determination of that issue by this court. And that's the position that we took in our reply brief. In addition to the sentencing guidelines issue, Your Honor, and we do think that the district court erred in its application of the commercial bribery. We think it was a reversible error for the district court not to conduct a hearing of the juror, Ms. Johnson, or Alexander, regarding the potential or the extrinsic influence on her by Mr. Bell.
We don't know. Mr. Bell testified that he didn't say a word about it, and no one asked for further testimony.
And I don't believe, Your Honor, that it's strictly the parties who are responsible for guarding what I think this court described in Harbin as a structural error.
But once the district court has some evidence in front of it that nothing amiss has occurred, how far is she supposed to dig? I mean, Mr. Bell did say, and she chose to believe him, I assume, that he had not discussed this with his friend, Ms. Alexander.
And I think, Your Honor, that the crucial aspect of this is Mr. Bell was not a juror. Mr. Bell was not sworn, didn't take an oath, didn't have an obligation to participate in the trial proceedings. This court's determinations when there is an issue regarding a juror and the jury impact on the jury of extrinsic influence says that prejudice is presumed, partially because it is so difficult for a defendant necessarily to prove it. But at a minimum, I think the district court was obliged, and I think Rule 606B of the Federal Rules of Evidence contemplates that a juror be questioned concerning the extrinsic influence. Once the district court learned that Mr. Bell's own testimony indicated that daily he was traveling with Ms. Alexander back and forth to court, accompanying her back and forth on the train rides, I think that the district court had an independent obligation, not to speak of perhaps the parties to suggest it, but nevertheless the district court, to inquire of the juror, whether it was before counsel or outside of counsel. My rebuttal time is up.
No.
I'm sorry.
You have a minute.
And I believe that prejudice...
I'm mandated to use it, Ms. Bowles.
No, I'm ready to talk. I believe that prejudice was presumed as a consequence of the failure to conduct that hearing. Mr. Bell observed quite a bit of activity in the courtroom, and among the activity he observed was issues respecting Mr. Rusin and the dissemination of Mr. Rusin's testimony. Another concern, I think, in terms of the conduct of the trial overall, that in circumvention of the court's order excluding witnesses, somehow Mr. Rusin's testimony was disseminated to prospective witnesses of his very same firm. Just exactly what its impact might have been is difficult to know, but certainly it permitted witnesses to conform their testimony to be consistent. And as you know, we think the Rusin testimony was incredible. For all those reasons, we would request that you reverse the convictions and remand for new trial, and alternatively remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bogart. Our thanks to all counsel, and Ms. Bogart, our special thanks to you and Mr. Collins for accepting the appointment in your respective cases. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. The court will take a very brief recess.